Listeners to episode 6. Before we begin, let's go through some quick housekeeping. We are ACE approved, so if you're listening for CEs, pop over to our website, atypicalba.com, and fill in the corresponding form with all the relevant information, put in the two keywords you'll hear in this episode, and we'll send your certificate to you within a couple days. If you'd like to spark some conversation, you can check us out on Facebook at the Atypical Behavior Analyst. Now on to the fun stuff. In this talk, I get really excited to meet with my cohort Becky Herring and the UK SBA OBM SIG to learn about the variety of settings behavior analytic principles can be applied, especially in the realm of human performance. So grab your towel and adjust your earbuds while Becky regales us with some of the similarities she discovered while exploring her career paths and provides some examples of how to apply principles with different levels of performers. So welcome to episode 6, Human Performance Across Multiple Settings, or Finding Commonalities Among the Stars. So the interstellar journey of Miss Becky Herring begins well before she ever became a behavior analyst and extends well beyond ever, I won't say ever using, but using maybe that phrase specifically, because I think as a lot of us are finding out, it may not be as relevant in different areas and in different settings. So with that, we're just going to kind of do an interview. I've given her an idea of questions that we have in mind. And so we'll kind of go through her journey. And then I've also asked to have some specific examples of like comparing the different environments that she's worked in. Since this is for a CE, you will get one learning credit type 2. If you remember the two keywords, so at about the halfway mark and then closer to the end. To start, Becky, welcome. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So if you could kind of let everybody know where you are in the world and kind of give a quick story, and then we'll launch more into the specifics.
Sure. Currently in Fort Worth, Texas, the primary location for Lockheed Martin. And like Kelly said, I'm a graduate of the UNT Department of Behavior Analysis. I received my master's in 2011, so 10 years ago now. And kind of had a whirlwind career after that. Really wanted to focus on animal training and behavior in the beginning and spent quite a while in that industry. I learned a lot. I wouldn't take it back for the world, but it was definitely not something that I wanted to stay in. The more experience I got, the more that I learned. And so when I was pregnant with my first child about 7 years ago, I was offered an opportunity from my father-in-law. He has a company that does government contracting. And he said, I know this is nothing like what you went to school for, but would you be interested in this? And it was something I really had to take some time to consider because it was a massive change in what I was doing. But we evaluated it and we kind of examined it as a family at the time, decided that was what was best. And the more that I got into government contracting, the more I started to see some parallels of how I could actually use behavior analysis in this industry as well, that there were pockets that you could really apply it to. Even if you're not technically called a behavior analyst, there are definitely areas where you can apply it pretty effectively. So that was kind of a fun learning experience. And then spent about 4 years with that company and then had an opportunity with Lockheed Martin. Lots of opportunity for growth and advancement. It's a huge corporation if you're familiar with it. Very large defense contractor. I think they're in the top 10. What's it called? Forbes top 50. It's a very, very interesting organization and lots of places that you can go. And that's it. And I've been there, it'll be 4 years this March. So I've been doing government contracting for 8 years now. That's a little about me.
So your journey had several parts, and I put together a little infographic that we'll send out to everybody afterwards. The first part of it is kind of, it's your before your behavior analytic career. Mm-hmm. I enjoy this part because it's just a fun moment in your life that I think is really nifty. But it also shows how things can derail our career plans. So I know, you know, for some of us, it's worked out really well. We went to school, then you go to university and everything's laid out perfectly. You know, you might have some hiccups here or there, but then there are some times that things happen and your entire, you know, train of thought or your shift, your focus just gets bombarded and gets derailed. So can you tell us kind of what happened with that?
Oh yeah, sure. So I had big dreams when I was 18. I think like a lot of teenagers, I really wanted to be a singer. Kelly and I have had many singing adventures together. We did a lot of karaoke in grad school. It was really fun, but went to go do my audition at the University of North Texas, which it also has a very large music program. It's very competitive, and went in, was very, very nervous. I had never been trained professionally, completely bombed my audition, and I was devastated. And so I'm in my dorm room as a freshman in college, and I'm crying, and I'm eating Ben and Jerry's. And I remember watching The Crocodile Hunter, and growing up, I'd always loved animals. And so I sat there thinking, well, if I can't do what I really love, which is music, I also love working with animals. So let me go figure out what I can do to go apply this. I knew I didn't want to be a veterinarian, but I wanted to do something. I just didn't know what that was. And so I went and I spoke to my advisor and I said, what other opportunities are there in the animal industry? And he said, well, have you ever thought about training? And I said, no. And he told me a little bit more about it and the opportunities that were there. And I said, okay, well, how do I even begin to do something like that? And we kind of had to look at what credits I already had. And, you know, you don't want to throw away a year's worth of work and all of that money for university. So he said, why don't we do this? Why don't, instead of you completely shifting majors and having to take all of these courses over again, why don't you do a focus in three areas? And so those focuses were biology, psychology, and behavior analysis. And I was fascinated by the behavior analysis portion of it. I took all the introductory classes, was very, very interested in it. And while I was an undergrad, I found the animal training group at North Texas called ORCA. It's the Organization for the Reinforcement Contingencies with Animals. If you're familiar with them, it was led by Jesus Rosales. I'm not sure who it's led by these days. It's been a while. He might still lead it.
It's still Jesus.
Still him? Okay. But got involved with them, became very active, and they actually opened the doors for a lot of hands-on opportunities working with animals. And we were allowed to go to wildlife museum and work with exotic animals that I'd never been hands-on with before. And really allowed us these chances to practice everything that we had learned so far and working with a variety of species. And worked with Dr. Rosales and wrote my thesis with him. My thesis, it sounds very fancy, but it's really funny when you read it. It was called Competing Contingencies. And so essentially it was investigating fear responses in a dog. But all I was doing was torturing my dog with a vacuum cleaner and then recording what I saw. And so essentially we were trying to counter condition the vacuum cleaner. So we had different phases of the experiment and took the baseline and then tried counter conditioning and all of these different things and variables. But it was really, really fun looking back on it. But yeah, that's how I kind of stumbled, for lack of a better word, into behavior analysis. So once I graduated, decided I really wanted to move on and get my master's and become more involved and advance my education, and applied and got in.
I'm torn because part of me is like, oh, we can go a little bit more. But I think talking about working with animals is fascinating. And you also had a chance to work in like larger organizations. So the Heard Wildlife Museum is a smaller organization here in North Texas, but you've also had a chance to work in the Shedd Aquarium, which is up in Chicago and is a huge facility that does training and I want to say rehabilitation too. Ken Ramirez used to work there. He recently retired, I believe, but he was brought in for the Exxon Valdez gas spill back in the early 90s, specifically to help rehabilitate otters. I remember getting a chance to go with ORCA, and we got to go behind the scenes and see how large these bad boys can actually get. And it was really amazing because he's a fantastic animal trainer too. So I wonder if you could give us some of the experiences you had in the Shedd and then also at the Fort Worth Zoo.
Yeah. So once I got into graduate school, one of the things that we had to do was go take on some internships, and went and did one at the Shedd Aquarium. And it was actually probably one of the longest internships that any student had done at that time. It was for 6 months and it was completely unpaid. So had to go up to Chicago from Texas, which is a massive weather shift. Had to live up there during the winter. Incredibly cold. I was not at all prepared, but ended up living with a couple of roommates who were really, really fun. And it was a wonderful experience. But working at the Shedd Aquarium, it's a little bit daunting at first because it's huge and it's a very well-run, well-organized facility. The staff are amazing. They work so hard and they care so much for those animals. One of the things that I really admired was the way that they train new staff. So every time they bring in a group of new interns, they have a little bit of overlap between the old interns, and the old interns will train the new interns so that the staff don't really have to take time away from their daily activities. And they, I don't know, there's a model for this. And Kelly, I apologize, all of my behavior analytic jargon has gone after 10 years. But there's a number of steps in the coaching. And so essentially the first one is that they model what they're doing. And most of what we did was food prep and cleaning because we're interns, but it was a modeling. And then they would have you verbally repeat it back to them. And then they would have you model what they showed you. And then they would have you do it a number of times where they wouldn't prompt or coach or provide any feedback. And I think it was 3 or 4 times you had to demonstrate full capabilities of the skill. And there was a checklist of all of these different skills that you had to learn. And once you were completely checked off on each of these activities, then you were allowed to go about unsupervised. So I always thought that was a really amazing way of doing it. And it was very, very thorough. And with that, they never had to worry about the quality of work that they were getting from their interns because everyone was trained so well, even though you had this high turnover rate of, you know, 2 brand new groups a year of about 20 students. And then from that, working with Ken Ramirez as an intern, we didn't do a lot of one-on-one work with him. We did have some staff meetings, and I just remember he always had the most phenomenal animal stories. If you didn't know, he actually got to go train Barack Obama's dogs while he was in the White House, but it was kind of secretive at the time. And so there was the picture on the refrigerator of one of the dogs, and I looked at one of the trainers, and I was like, whose dog is this? And he goes, oh, that's Barack Obama's. I'm like, why is it on the refrigerator? And he goes, and it was kind of on the hush hush at the time, but I always thought that was amazing. And so he came back with this really funny story of he was playing the shaping game with the 2 daughters, and what they wanted Ken to do was to go touch the Secret Service agent that was at the end of the hall. And he started to figure out what they were trying to shape him to do. And he looked at the Secret Service agent, and the Secret Service agent just goes like that and just shakes his head. And Ken goes, okay, we're going to pick a different behavior. And then they went off down the other end of the hall. But he was such a fun person to work with and to listen to and learn from, in addition to all of his staff. But we did, towards the end of the internship, we got to be a little bit more hands-on with all of the animals. So we got to do some training sessions with the dolphins, with the beluga whales, with a couple of the otters, penguins. They had some birds that were in the back that they used for some of their shows, like owls and a hawk, and just a really cool variety of animals. But yeah, it was really, really neat being there. So wouldn't take it back for anything, even though we worked really hard and didn't get paid at all.
That was such an amazing experience. I was thinking I've heard it used in different ways. So discriminate, operate, generate, when it comes to teaching competencies, you know, can the person discriminate between the correct response and the incorrect? Can they then follow through with an example of it, the operate, and then generate is doing it on your own? Lead, model, test, and extend, I think, is similar to what you were saying. So my question is, they did all of that up front and you guys are there for about 6 months. Were there any probes during, or was it just really, you guys were so fluent that you didn't need to have any, if that makes sense, on like continuing that?
Yeah, I don't remember them coming in and doing random probes at all. I think on occasion, if there was, if a mistake was made, then they would come in and probe and have them walk through it again and ensure that the training was still there. But as far as random probes throughout the 6 months, mm-mm.
So to kind of shift gears a little bit, you've had these wonderful experiences with my preferred species of animals in general. I like humans. I accept them, but we're really difficult to get along with. So I'm much more like, let me hang out with my dog. And but I want to shift gears to the human side now, because you did have that several year experience of working in a prison system. And when we were kind of discussing things yesterday, one of the professors that we had at UNT, Dr. Janet Ellis, actually tried to go work in some of the prison systems here in Texas. So she went in with the hopes of trying to look at recidivism rates, because we do see most of the inmates, they'll finish their time and then they'll get out, or they'll be allowed on parole and they come back because no one will hire them. There's nobody there to assist them. There's no mentorship. They don't have any functional skills. And all anyone reads is, you know, whatever their, you know, felon or misdemeanor. And so it's difficult. And so I wonder, you know, I have all of these thoughts in my head about what it looks like on the inside. And I know that unfortunately our field has not done a good job of kind of following through with this. So while you were working there, I guess just start with, what was it like? Like, what was a day as a consultant for you like when you went?
What we did specifically was we were the medical contracting for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And so essentially when you get into government contracting, if you're not familiar with it, the US government essentially has to solicit for services for specific things. So when you're within the Department of Justice and then the Bureau of Prisons, they release requests for proposals. And then you as a contractor have to submit the proposal with pricing and services in the hopes that you will win that award. And so we were what's called a small disabled veteran owned business. So in the US government, there's all these different classifications for small business, and that's what we were. And so essentially we had about 5 or 6 active contracts at the time. And all we did was ensure that our inmates received medical care. So we did billing, we did scheduling, we worked with the doctors to make sure that the appointments were all set up correctly. And what I started to learn is that it's hard to describe. They gear more towards psychology because in the contracting world, you can bill for a psychologist because that's a doctor. Even though what they probably really needed was a BCBA, at this point in time, they had no way to solicit for that. They had no way to bill and charge for it, to pay someone who could have come in and been really useful. And I don't know what the future looks like for that. Right now, they really just look for psychologists or someone with an MD. And it's frustrating, you know, because I saw the same thing where, you know, we were seeing they were receiving medical care for assault or, you know, we didn't have any riots while I was there, but, you know, there would be fights and stuff within some of the cell blocks. You think, well, what could we have done to prevent that? And I even read a case study where there was, it wasn't any of our prisons, but during this case study in this paper, the inmates were very agitated and very angry, and they were trying to figure out what was going on. And it was only in this specific area. Well, they did an analysis and come to find out it's because their shower water was cold. And so they were taking cold showers every day, and these guys were frustrated. So they brought in a contractor to come fix the plumbing, and then all of the aggression went down just because of a cold shower. So those are the kinds of things that would be really, really beneficial in that industry. But I'm not sure how soon we're going to get there. And I don't know what it would take to get us there either. So I'm hoping that there's somebody really passionate about that field that's in behavior analysis that may be able to kind of get that rolling and see what else we can do to help them out. It's a little bit easier when you're talking about state and county because they operate differently. But when you're working with federal prisons, it's pretty strict and rigid how they bring people in and contract with them.
Systems are or can be very difficult to navigate and trying to find who to ask the questions, where to continue to ask questions. And so often people, you know, we've discussed, you know, feedback is difficult and we forget to ask the people that we're supposed to be working with, you know, what do you want? What's actually going on? So I find it fascinating that how you could have prevented so many things by someone just listening or asking them, you know, why are you guys so agitated? Everybody's so agitated all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So at this point, what I think is really cool is you've had all of these multiple experiences working with humans, non-humans, in very small like systems organizations, and then also getting into larger and larger ones. And even if you're not working directly in those larger systems, seeing the impact of them as they fall down or as it comes down. So which I think is really cool because that leads into what you're currently doing and kind of how you got here and how you fit as a covert behavior analyst, we'll say, doing what you do. So if you can kind of give a quick description of your position currently, because I know that you've recently been promoted, and you could also kind of describe a little bit about the system that you're working in, if that makes sense.
Sure. So with Lockheed Martin, specifically within the aeronautics department, and then underneath that, supply chain. And so if you are not familiar with supply chain, essentially we procure all of the items that we would need to build our jets, like the F-35, the C-130, the F-16, those sorts of things. And so when I was hired on 4 years ago, I was hired in as a buyer, specifically on the international team, which was a really wonderful introduction to the company, because as a buyer, you learn all of the regulations, everything that we have to do with our contracting, our terms and conditions, things like that. And being on the international side, you get to work with these countries overseas that you probably never would have met anybody from before. So I was Northern Europe. So I had Denmark, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Norway, and got to meet and work with some really amazing people. Very cool. Just, you know, very high up in their industries. Got to go see a brand new facility that was built in the Netherlands. It was a machining company, and it was actually state of the art. They're getting really invested in robotics over there. It was really, really cool because I'd never seen anything like that before. But then also had some opportunities to work with some smaller machine shops here in the States. A lot of them are located out in California in the Los Angeles area. And the nickname for them is mom and pop shops, but they're really just more small businesses. And that was really cool too, to see from the small business end of it, how they operate and how they bid on the Lockheed Martin contracts. So I came in as a buyer and worked my way up essentially into what we call a level three position, which is just a promotion. You just kind of work your way up those steps. And then after a few years, there was an opportunity to go on the operations and the program management side of things. And I came in with no experience of project management or operations, but I had an idea of what that department did. And I knew that the primary role of that department is to make things better. They are all about process improvement. And so I went, okay, well, that's kind of what I do. I make things better. And so went and applied. I actually got the job. And then now for the last 8 months or so, it's been a very sharp learning curve because as a buyer, everything is black and white. Your rules are very clear. And then when you come into project management and operations, you kind of operate in this world that is shades of gray. And so you have to take these ideas, you identify a problem and you say, okay, I see that there's this problem. You go speak to people, you try to identify a root cause. And then from that, you try to come up with a solution. And what I've learned, and again, this is just my personal experience, a lot of what I see is it's not necessarily a training issue for performance. You know, Lockheed Martin is very stringent on their hiring. We hire amazing people right out of school or from other industries, things like that. It's really more an issue of access to the right tools. We have hundreds of places to go to access the tools that you need to perform your job. And I think sometimes that people just can't find them. And so they either end up asking other people for help or they try to figure it out on their own. And so a lot of what I've been doing since I started is trying to reduce the number of locations for the tools and really consolidate it down so they have one place to go to access what they need. And then from that, it also is a great stress reliever too, because you don't have people that are so anxious about and frustrated about where to go to find what they need to do their job. So that's one thing of what I do.
I'm going to stop you real quick just because at time-wise, for CE purposes, your first word is sing, S-I-N-G. All right. So you were talking about, which I really was digging, the we make things better portion of it, because I feel like as behavior analysts going into, it's just, I don't know, it's an unspoken ethical code of ours, is that's what we look for. We look for reinforcing contingencies. We look for how to improve things, and just making a simple change of, let's just put all the resources over here, starts to alleviate all those problems. So when you are doing these, when you're working with your teams and everything, what does your data gathering process look like? Like, how are you going out and seeking feedback from them, making changes, like your follow-up process with that? What does that kind of look like?
So a lot of it is dependent on the primary issue. And so in the corporate world, you know, we're always looking for what's called a root cause, or, you know, why is this happening? We do a lot of surveys. When you have an organization this large, and if you're seeing an issue across a large population of people, the easiest way to gather data in a corporation is a survey. But what I've learned is that you have to be very specific with your questions. And that's something that I've been able to provide feedback with our teams about, because sometimes they get in there and they'll put, you know, the responses or the options to answer the questions are very vague. And I want to get a little bit more behavioral, a little bit more objective, and say, okay, well, that's good, but what if we did this instead? And so being able to allow the survey to have more appropriate answers, I think, is step one. And then from there, evaluate. Lockheed Martin is, it's actually really great because they're incredibly data-driven. So everybody loves graphs. We love data. We love presenting all of the data in different ways. So that's been really nice because that's a world that I'm very comfortable in. And so from that, it just kind of depends on how you're going to utilize it. If it's an internal project where we take it just to my team and we say, okay, here's the problem. We found a trend. Now, what are we going to do to address it? And then we go work that, as opposed to, okay, leadership has identified this problem. We have directors and VPs. We need you to go fix this. And then it's a little bit more complex because we have to take all of that data, put it into a very formal presentation, have it checked over several times. Sometimes there's publication criteria that we have to go through. If it's going to be released to the public, we have to go through that and then present it to the leadership and ensure that our path forward is the correct one and is what they're looking for. So then once we are actually applying the change management principles, there is a phrase that we use quite a lot called check and adjust. So we look at performance, we continue to collect data during the change management process. And then if it's not being effective, then we tweak something. And that's a really helpful way to go, okay, well, you know, this isn't doing exactly what I thought it would do. So we're just going to change it a little bit to improve performance. Because when you're working with a corporation, you know, you're always looking to save money, to make money. You don't really have a lot of time to say, well, no, I want to run this for 3 months and then I'll do it. You kind of have to move a little bit quicker than that. So if it's not working, you change it and then you evaluate it again. And if it's still not working, change it, evaluate it again until you get those results that you need.
There's a lot there. Variables that I hadn't even considered, thinking about, you know, things going out for publication, who's going to have the availability to read it. Because I know in my very narrow world of working with individuals with disabilities, you know, my stakeholders don't go that far up. I don't have to think about who's going to see it. It's me. It's the case manager. But when you do get into these bigger corporations, yeah, there's a whole lot more influence and a whole lot of other motivating things that happen. You were talking about the survey, which I thought was really interesting because I know my still small physical, you know, emotional response to surveys is I kind of want to cringe a little bit. I've gotten better mm-hmm. over the years because there is value in them. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you were starting to allude to it, you know, making sure that the verbiage that we have is accurate. And then I think too, that we're also all on the same page of what were the purpose of it. Cause I feel sometimes mm-hmm. surveys just get put out as a thing, like, you know, how do you like your job? You know, how is this going? And it's mm-hmm. the results aren't really used in that way. And so it sounds like you guys have developed a tool and you're helping to modify it that actually does lead to pretty substantial changes down the road. So for you mm-hmm. and in your position, what makes a good survey question? And like, what's a good survey overall?
I think if they're short, shorter is better. We do send out a lot of surveys in our corporation. And so we have to be very conscious of survey fatigue is what they call it. And try to keep it to maybe 10 questions or less. There are a couple that go out that cover the entire corporation. And I'm trying to remember, it has a name, but there maybe once a year, they send out one that's like 50 questions or so. And so that's the one that we don't have any control over that, but for the ones that we can influence and that we can control, try to keep them short and try to make your questions fairly specific and fairly objective. I'm not a big fan of the rating scale, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, how satisfied were you? I don't like those, but I think people default to them because they're easy. I would rather have really clear and objective results in mind. So to give an example, in supply chain, one of the things that we are always battling are shortages. You know, are the parts that I need for the jet, are they here on time or are they not? Because all of that affects the US government. And so one of the things that we are trying to build is a tool to allow our leadership to determine what is one of the largest root causes for our shortages. And having come from the buying world, you know, they had put in 4 responses in there, and looking at them, you know, we have these 4 responses, but I'm looking at one of them going, this needs to be a lot more specific because you say this, but there's actually several things that fall underneath this one that we really need to capture. And so that was some of the feedback that was provided is, okay, sure. You know, you have it's called supplier performance, but we need to dig deeper. Well, why is the supplier not performing? Do they have staff or personnel issues? Are they, do they have capacity issues? Do they have too much work in-house where they just can't keep up with it anymore? Are one of their sub-tiers not performing? So when you start to go out to suppliers, you know, supply chain is just, it trickles down. So our suppliers have their suppliers that provide them with the parts and the material that they need. And sometimes their stuff is late, which in turn affects us as the primary contractor. So all of those things you have to be really specific and evaluate. And then what that will do is if the leadership is more aware of those, they can go work with the teams and with the buyers and say, okay, your supplier has said this, now how can you go work to fix this? And it allows the buyer an opportunity to pinpoint the root cause and then go talk to their supplier and formulate a plan of action. So all of that helps to reduce our shortages in the long run.
That's awesome. I just realized I need to actually get like a tablet that's higher up when I write notes, because I just keep like disappearing. Because I'm like, oh, that's a brilliant thing she said. I have a follow-up question. Kelly just like an elevator. I apologize, guys. But I think one of the follow-up questions that I wanted to ask you was, you know, what do you do with these results? What's important? But you tacted it so beautifully there of when you ask these specific questions and you get more detail up front, you don't have to deal with as much fallout. You're able, like you said, to pinpoint so much more accurately and so much faster rather than, and I've seen root cause analyses go on for hours and hours. And it's just because trying to ask all those other questions takes time. And if you have it up front and you, I'm sure some of this has been developed out of like trends that you've seen. So these are the common problems. And then having other questions maybe that kind of capture the outlier moments. So when you come across these changes and you get the results back and you see, okay, we need to work on X, Y, and Q, you send the teams out, they go and do the thing. And you said it's a pretty quick turnaround on reevaluating those changes. How quick usually does that happen?
Usually it's provided by feedback. And so we have a lot of tools that we use in-house that the leadership will examine and the buyers will put in their notes, you know, I have done this. And then everything is measured by what's called an estimated completion date, or an ECD. The U.S. government and contractors love acronyms. Everything is an acronym. And so if you know, that ECD is really our target goal. So we watch the date, and if the date improves, then we know we've done the correct action. We were able to improve the delivery date. Our shortage has been eliminated. If the date holds, that's fine. You know, we haven't gotten any worse. We'll take it. And if it moves out, then we know it's not working. It's a really concrete way to measure whether or not our buyers are getting involved with their suppliers and if they're able to kind of get in there and do some risk management with them.
So at this point, I kind of feel like we could take it one step further. And so you're working still in that very kind of, I'm going to call it a surface level of just seeing the organization as just blocks and pieces. But I mean, each of those blocks and pieces is a human, and those humans are the ones that are giving the survey responses. So if you're looking at the dates and okay, cool, the date changes, do you guys ever go back and look and see if the attitudes or the behaviors of the staff or the people that are the actual employees, are they changing at all?
This is an area that's really interesting, and I think this is where it really comes into the organizational behavior management side of things. The teams all have different cultures, and it really depends on the culture of the team that you're working with. A lot of our teams, you have a manager, and I think their cap is maybe 10 to 12 employees each, and every team works differently. And usually you can see it in the performance of their work. So the teams with fewer shortages will have a little bit higher morale, a little more camaraderie, everybody gets along a little bit better. And then the teams that maybe have more shortages, you don't see that as much. You know, there may be some strife, or, you know, may have higher turnover on that team, things like that. So you can sort of tell what's going on. But as far as going into an individual level and approaching the buyer one-on-one, it's not something that we do in our department. That would really be more a recommendation that we would make to the leadership to say, hey, we noticed that this buyer is really struggling. All of their suppliers are having shortages. Maybe we want to go talk to them, see if this is a training issue. Is it a resource issue? Is it a morale? Is something happening at home? And so we would provide that recommendation to the management to go talk to them.
That's fascinating. I wonder how often management follows through with that. I'm not going to put you on the spot and have you answer that question.
That's a good question. good managers will. I will say that.
And I think because it's such a harsh thing to have to go into and ask, why are you mad? Why do you not like coming to work? Because we don't often want to hear that as supervisors or owners of companies or managers. It's really tough because that means we also probably need to do some shifting and changing behaviors on our end as well. So a question that popped up, what behavioral issues can cause these supply chain issues? So if it's not just, you know, if something is late, it's not just you know, sometimes there's natural events like weather happens. You know, we see snowpocalypse happens or rain happens anywhere in Texas and everything shuts down.
COVID.
And COVID literally has shut everything down. So it's very much, when we break it down to the micro here, it's very much behavioral things that do impact these, you know, these long-term effects. So what are some of those things that you've come across or that you maybe see trend within the different organizations you've worked in that can impact these human performers?
So one of the things that we would monitor as buyers is quality. And so we would always have, they were called a supplier quality engineer on site. And their job was to basically make sure, okay, I have this part that goes on the jet. I need to make sure that it's built correctly. And so they would look at all of the paperwork. They would thoroughly examine it and determine yes or no. You built it correctly. It passes our criteria. You are allowed to ship it. One of the things I remember is I had a supplier that was struggling with it's called sealant. And so when you have a nut or a bolt on an assembly part, your sealant has to be very clean. So you think of it like caulk on a bathtub. You want really nice, clean, smooth lines. Same thing on a jet. Well, it was really messy. And then also it wasn't curing correctly. And so now you're kind of getting into the chemistry of it, which is you wear many different hats in this role. So the quality engineer said, we're getting part after part where their sealant isn't curing correctly. I don't know what they're doing wrong. And I said, well, have you watched them mix it? Because you have a, what's it called? An activator. And then you have the primary sealant and then you mix them together. And he goes, no, I'll watch them do it next time. Well, what they were doing was trying to measure it because it came in this big kit. And they were trying to measure it and then mix little batches that they needed and then apply it. Well, they were mixing it incorrectly. And what we had to do is say, okay, you're gonna have to actually mix all of it together and then apply it because this chemical is made for all of it to mix together at the same time. You can't really measure it out correctly and have that be safe for us to install on the jets. And so that was our corrective action. And so things like that happen all the time where it's, you know, your supplier is, they're trying to go faster or they're trying to save money, which is, it's not a bad thing. You know, they're trying to improve their own performance, but along the way, a mistake was made. And then you have to go in there, identify what's going on and provide them a solution. Because, you know, our point is, well, you may save a little bit of money or you may save some time, but if we reject this part, then you're not saving any money. You need to make the part right the first time, every time. So that's just one example, but there's a ton of them out there.
I think that's a really good one because I know when I was taking the couple of OBM classes that I did, one of the kind of mantras we would have was, you know, it's going to cost you a bit upfront. It's going to take time. It's going to take resources. It's going to take effort. But in the long run, it's going to pay off. And this is such a great example of, on the flip side, if you try to do things too quickly, you're still going to have a payoff in the long run, but it's not going to work out for you. So it just shows the value of taking that time up front to invest in the product, the people, you know, making sure that they're trained and that they're competent and going back and double checking. So that's really cool. Another question that it kind of had come up in my head was when we were talking about feedback and you mentioned that you can see the different like cultures, you know, those that are in a more positive reinforcing environment versus those that are a little bit more, use the word strife, which I dig. I think it's a real, that's a good emotion. What do you see that makes that differentiation? Like what's a clear discrimination between like, I see this going on with this company and here's why, or here's the variables that I see going into it. Like managers say things or managers are involved versus this other one that doesn't. What does that line look like?
Oh, that one's tricky because I don't want to get myself in trouble.
With humans in general, then maybe with okay. previous organizations too, you know, when you've worked, because this isn't just about, you know, where you're currently at, but also how you've mm-hmm. seen, you know, we've all been in positions, every position you're in, you get feedback from somebody and there's mm-hmm. a culture there as well. And so maybe we'll put it this way, in environments, in settings where you have felt valued as an employee, regardless mm-hmm. of your position, either being in one of management or seniority, or as being more low level, you know, direct care. What did those environments look like to you when you were like, this is rad, this is what I want to keep doing, or what I want to, in your position now, emulate with my corporation?
I think a lot of the characteristics that I've seen in good managers that I have had in all of my previous careers was they're involved. They pay attention and they take the time to speak to you and to listen and remember. Managers, my husband has been a manager for 10 years, and we kind of have this running joke that it's a lot like babysitting, because it can be that you can get sucked into the drama and it can be exhausting at times, but a good manager will speak to his people one-on-one and then also take the opportunities to do team building and pay attention to the dynamics of the team and what works and what doesn't, and then also find opportunities for promotion and success. Know what the reinforcers are for each of your employees. We actually did an analysis where we took a survey and said, how do you prefer your, we call it recognition, but it's reinforcement. How do you prefer your recognition? Because some people don't want to be recognized in front of a large crowd for something that they did well. They would much rather receive the thanks one-on-one behind the scenes, and other people love it. They love being the center of attention. Some people want something that they can actually tact and hold, like a thank you card. Other times digital is great. Sometimes verbal is okay. It just really depends on the person. And so we were able to kind of look across our organization and see what the majority of people preferred. And that was a really cool thing for the leadership to know was, okay, well, we have these tools. Do people even like the tools that we use? Are they working? And we found out, yeah, they are working. People do prefer this recognition that we give. But yeah, management is definitely something you have to practice it, and you have to continue to get better and evolve as a good leader and a good manager, because it's I think some people have those foundational skills, but you definitely develop it over time.
That's awesome. That is the most amazing survey for reinforcers for adults I've ever heard. because I'm one of those, no, I don't want public recognition. Please do not make me go mm-hmm. stand in front of people or stand up. Like, what do I do with my hands?
Yeah.
No, I would much prefer a, hey, that was cool. Or send me an email, mm-hmm. send me a meme that says you did awesome. And so I'm glad that you mentioned that, because it's so valuable to go back and double check those things with people. And then taking it to the more uncomfortable side of, if you go and you have to have a feedback session with somebody, you know, whether it's just a regular observation or maybe there is an issue and you need to go have a discussion about it, having a talk with them about their preference on that. You know, do you prefer to do it on the phone, through Zoom? If we can do face-to-face, is that possible? How do you want me to set this up? Because I think a lot of us have a history of, you know, getting the text that says, you know, we need to talk from your boss. And all mm-hmm. of a sudden your heart either stops or it just, you know, mine just automatically started racing even as I said it, because it's been paired with usually punishment or you're being scolded for something, or, you know, it's admonishing in some way. So do you guys have anything like that? Do you ask them how they prefer to receive their like performance evaluations?
We do. Yeah, there's actually a lot of trainings available in our system, which is one of the other things I love about Lockheed. They have thousands of trainings for whatever you could want to learn. And so that is one of them, is exactly how to deliver your feedback for people. Because I think there was kind of this old school way of doing it that they called it the sandwich. And it was like good, negative, and then good. And that was supposed to make everything okay. But we all know that all anyone takes away is the negative feedback. And so there is a training, and I've only seen it once. I need to go back and watch it again. But it basically, it acknowledges that negative feedback, it's not bad. but the way that you deliver it can be really, really important. And so it said, we're just going to teach you, instead of this, which is a lot of people default to like these phrases, try saying this instead. And so it was giving you some replacement behaviors to deliver some feedback that may not be so positive for your employee. But we have a lot of opportunities for feedback at Lockheed. They're very encouraging about setting up one-on-ones with your managers. We have scheduled one-on-ones twice a year, but even then they say, if you have anything that you want to talk to them about, even going as far up to your senior manager, director, VP, they're all very open and they're very responsive. That was something that I was a little bit skeptical of when I stepped into the role at Lockheed Martin was, does this huge corporation listen to their employees? And what I've learned is that yes, they do. It takes time because it's a huge company, and to shift the behavior of a huge organization, it just takes a lot longer than you would like. But they do take the feedback and they listen to it and they try to resolve the issues that come up from the employees. And I love seeing that and being able to be a part of it.
And it sounds like they take these considerations and actually do something with them quickly. Like, it's not just you're going to have some result within, you know, a month or so, which I think is just awesome, because, you know, a lot of times feedback just kind of gets lost in the wind or something else takes precedence it's nice to hear that, no, they take their people very seriously, which is talking about good management and good organization skills. Yeah. Your humans are valuable, which is greatness. So we're kind of rounding out, and I want to go ahead and give a second word, which is dolphin. D-O-L-P-H-I-N. I will always try to spell things out on the words for other people's benefit as well. With these last few minutes, I want to have kind of two-part question for you. So first off, what are some of the similarities as you have this vast, diverse career that you've been able to pull from and say, this looks similar and this looks similar. Let's see what happens. What are some of those similarities and differences between working with the animals and then the corporate world?
Some of the similarities that I saw was environmental arrangement is very, very important. Like I said previously, the access of the tools, if people cannot access the tools to do their job, their performance is going to suffer. We have to be able to put the tools somewhere easy to access. And then also even the name of the tool. We have so many tools at our disposal at Lockheed, but you have to remember, okay, well, it's called this, but it actually does this. It's kind of like when I download an app on my phone and the app is called something really weird, but all it does is open my garage door. It's that kind of thing. So being sure that we name our tools adequately is really important. Another item is simple reinforcement. You don't have to overthink it in the corporate world. Praise goes a long way. I can't tell you how many times food, simple things like candy, because we're such a huge organization that little things really matter. So bringing candy, or if the managers bring some food for their employees, appropriate touch like fist bumps and high fives before COVID, that stuff is really, really valuable. So don't forget about things like those.
And I'm going to stop you right there just because.
Yes, ma'am.
I had to remind myself that you're actually talking about adults.
Yes.
because my brain went, well, I mean, I'm an adult. I'm trying to be an adult, but I like candy and fist bumps and high five. And I forget that other adults who actually do adulting things also enjoy that. It's not just what kids like to do. So thank you for pointing that out and reminding me.
You are very welcome. But every organism is different. Acknowledge that reinforcement type and delivery is going to vary from person to person and even from team to team. Some of our teams like really loved pizza parties. And then other teams, it was kind of like, pizza, really? So you have to be very conscientious of what the individual and what the teams prefer. And then also training the trainer. So this is something that as you get into training managers or training the leadership, you become disconnected from the organism of focus, but you're still teaching these skills to the people who will be applying them directly, if that makes sense. So that was something that was also a parallel, is instead of training an animal trainer, you're training a manager or a leader on how to work with their employees.
Yeah, that's perfect. If you could give, for those who are interested in starting to explore this world of organizational behavior management, interested in working in corporations or kind of branching out into that, What are your takeaways? What are your lessons learned, if you will?
I think these are some of the things that I've learned along my career and as things kind of shifted and evolved. Definitely keep an open mind. If you start graduate school or you start your career knowing I want to do this, and then as you get more into it and it's not quite what you thought it was, that's okay. Careers are going to change. Your goals are going to change. My priority when I got pregnant, I have two beautiful little girls now, but it was finances. You know, I was never going to make enough money that I felt like I really should earn with my degree and my knowledge working in the animal industry. And so I made that shift and it was hard, but I would not take it back for the world. So be okay with the changes that you're going to experience. I think behavior analysis is also going to sneak into all aspects of your life. It sneaks into my parenting, significant others, which drives my husband angry. And then your advice for friends, you're going to find yourself being really behavior analytical when you deliver advice. And then my last two are really more career focused. Build your network. Go to meet and greets. Go get to know people in the industries. 90% of my jobs were because of who I knew, not what I knew. And I think that was a really hard lesson to learn, but it's incredibly valuable. So definitely build your networks. And then also find some mentors. Find one that has similar goals and that's very similar to you, personality and drive wise, and then find one that's really different and maybe that you wouldn't think that you would want to go to. But when you go pair up and you become mentored by someone who's really different, you're going to learn a lot more as well. So I would say those are my takeaways from everything I've learned over the past, 15 years now.
Does anyone want to ask Becky any questions, or do you have any thoughts you'd like to share?
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
So early or at some point, I have all my notes I'm looking down at because I have a lot of them. I had the question of like, you know, do you get to do a lot of direct observation in the job you do? Because you had mentioned like surveys. And so it's kind of like in my mind, I'm picturing kind of separate, you know, kind of separate from the actual like frontline workers, that kind of thing. But then you mentioned later on an issue about like, you asked someone, well, have you watched them mix the sealant? And so it's kind of like, I'm just thinking, how did you know to even ask that question? Like, do you get to do observations of people doing their work and things like that to be able to help you know what kind of questions to ask and what to kind of investigate?
As a buyer, I did. If you have a supplier that is underperforming, before COVID, we were actually encouraged to go on site and to watch what was happening. And I think having the behavior analytic background really gave me an edge on finding what the root causes were a little bit easier, because I knew nothing about machining or metal parts or aeronautics. I came in completely blank and had to be sort of self-taught, but I knew that, okay, well, if they're not performing, then what are you doing over here? Show me. And even things like my supplier had an assembly area and they had to make these huge complex assemblies that they'd never made before. And so we were able to look at even just the way that they had their assembly area laid out. It wasn't very conducive to working smoothly or efficiently. Their tools were all over the place and they had these posters that were falling down. And so we made recommendations to the CEO, who was he took every recommendation we made and applied it, which is actually kind of rare. And I always love that about him, but he put monitors in their facility. He started color coding items so that they could tell which items were priority and which were not. They got organized in their assembly area. They started, instead of having all of their assemblers do everything, they started training them. Okay, you are going to do steps 1 through 4. You're going to do 5 through 8. And so with that, they became a lot more efficient. But that was as a buyer. As a project manager, it's a lot more hands-off. You don't get to do as much direct observation. It's more of talking to employees and saying, well, have you tried this? Have you tried this? It's kind of taking that step back and you're a little bit more disconnected from it, but you can still apply the same principles.
One little kind of follow-up question to what you're saying. Like, so it kind of sounds like you didn't have any or little knowledge maybe at going in and applying for this job. So are you saying like, is it possible that a behavior analyst could go and apply to an organization that maybe they don't have a background knowledge on the company? Maybe obviously you need a little bit of knowledge to do the interview, but aside from that, like to really have the in-depth knowledge to kind of know what questions to ask as you're entering into that organization.
Absolutely. Yeah, there. I've met so many people from Lockheed Martin that they had career changes. My coworker that we used to share a cubicle together, we both came from the animal industry, and we kind of laughed because we're like, how did we wind up training dogs to building F-35s? This is a weird transition. But you have so many skills that they really transfer well, especially coming out of school and having an advanced degree. I will say a lot of it is how you word your resume. Lockheed Martin has, and a lot of the larger corporations have this, but when you submit a resume, they pick out keywords. So you have to be very careful on how you word it, because the very first wave of review is not done by a person. It's done by a computer program. So really look at what you're applying for and ensure that you are aligned with what they're looking for, because that's how they're going to be able to say, oh, okay, this person does look like they know about what I'm needing, what I'm hiring for. And then they'll pull your resume and actually give it to the hiring manager.
I had no idea. This answers so many questions about when I was a young, naive child trying to apply for jobs. Those are excellent questions, Shanna. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, thank you guys so much for coming. Thank you, Becky, for joining us and continuing our, this isn't the pollination, but yeah, we're getting really good at this cross the pond collaboration. I dig it. So thank you all for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. This was really fun.
Bye guys.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this adventure of the Atypical Behavior Analyst. Check out the website atypicalba.com for more episodes, references, and to purchase CEUs. To stay up to date, like and follow us on social media. Just search Atypical Behavior Analyst. If you like the show, please rate and leave us a review. And if you want to support the show but don't need CEUs, you can help by clicking the Buy Us a Coffee link in the show notes. So until next time, listeners, grab your towel, keep exploring, and we'll see you in the fringes.